And welcome, everyone, to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm not crazy, right? Are we live yet? We are, right?
Yep, we are live on Trek Radio.
See, that's what happens when I'm trying to look at the chat room and, you know, deal with all this at the same time. I just go nuts. Okay, so anyway, my apologies for that. This is All Things Trek, and I'm Oren, and unfortunately Bob could not meet us today, so... I have gathered another crack team of co-hosts. I have David providing engineering.
Krapla.
And I have Lillian, who you guys will all remember from last week.
Howdy.
And then, as I promised last week, I have the return of our special guest, Kathy Ferguson.
Hi, everybody.
And she's been with us a couple of times over the course of the show. Kathy, why don't you remind everybody what you do?
Well, I'm a professor at the University of Hawaii in political science and women's studies, and I teach a class, political theory in Star Trek.
Excellent. And that is like so, and that's where you go through the various Star Trek episodes and show like how they channel the various views of philosophers like Locke, and a couple of them use like Plato, Machiavelli, those
exactly,
guys.
Exactly. So I take the important what we call the canon of Western philosophy. Political philosophy, and show how their ideas are both reflected and critiqued in various Star Trek episodes that follow those same sort of narrative arcs, because philosophy is basically storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
So the stories in Star Trek often mirror the philosophies.
That's fair. And I really wanted to take that class. I was upset that I couldn't. But it's a lot of fun, and anyone who has listened to our show previously will remember that Kathy has really kind of classes up the joint, sort of what she does, and brings our discussion up to another level. We actually had an email last week specifically saying that he liked listening to you on the show. So speaking of emails, we only have one this week, and it is from Colin over from the Trek News and Views podcast. He says. The subject is Romulans, and it says, "Greetings. I listened to the Romulan cast with Hav and wanted to add a few things. The first time you see the rape gangs that Tash referred to was in the first season episode where No Man Has Gone Before, when the Traveler inadvertently takes them to the galaxy where your thoughts become reality. She has flashbacks to her old life. But yes, for someone who never made it to the end of season one, she did manage to mention it an awful lot." This was, we were talking a couple weeks back about... how often Tasha would bring up her backstory. And I don't remember it coming up all that often, but I know that some people like just remember her as talking about it all the time, as how terrible this planet she came from was. But anyway, he goes on to say, "Now, in relation to the Romulans, I've always liked them. They are in some ways very much like us. If the Ferengi were a reflection of human greed, then the Romulans are a reflection of our duplicity. I think a lot of politicians would make good Romulans, shaking you by the hand. But, oh wait, okay, I think that sentence got cut off, shaking you by the hand. But they were also a match for the Federation, both in technology and strength. When they joined the Dominion War, they hit 14 points simultaneously, clearly demonstrating the military might they could wield. It remains to be seen what Star Trek Online does with them in the new Romulan zone, but I, for one, am looking forward to playing it whilst indulging and interacting with one race that I really like from Star Trek, a race that has been with us since TOS. Anyway, great cast and all. Live long and podcast, Colin." So thank you very much for that, Colin. You are correct. I would love... I am, even though I don't play Star Trek Online, I am interested to see what they end up doing with the... I am interested in seeing what they do with them in the new Romulan zone. So that...
With the Tasha Yar and her backstory, it does occur to me that I don't... Like, within that first season, do we learn any backstories of anyone else?
We kind of learn that... Oh, no, I don't think so. We learn that Data was made by Dr. Sung. I think that's about it. I think we learn... Oh, maybe the first season is when we learn that Picard was the captain of the Stargazer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of his backstory. But we don't learn that he came from a family of technophobic like wine growers until much later.
Well, one thing that Tasha's backstory does is it allows... than to create an episode with her sister Ashara.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the backstory becomes much more relevant because Ashara turns out to be a resistance leader for one of the factions.
Sort of.
and you know, she ends up manipulating the crew to advance the interests of her group. So that wouldn't have made us... It would have been harder to tell that story if you didn't know where Tasha came from.
Yeah, and that episode was like season 4 when they finally got back to that one?
I can't say, I don't remember.
It was a while. Like I remember being a little confused when they was watching that episode, because they like the Tasha's sister appeared on the view screen, and we didn't know that she was Tasha's sister at that point. And everyone's like, Tasha? It's like so familiar. She looks like Tasha. I'm like, not really. I don't really think she looks like Tasha at all. She doesn't really remind me of Denise Crosby in any way. I was confused because they brought Denise Crosby back to play her daughter, but not her sister. Mm. And the whole point of her sister is that she's supposed to look a lot like her, but anyway. Go ahead.
I was trying to think back to season 1 about backstories, and we get a touch of it on Riker, but more about his career, you know, that he didn't let his captain beam down, and that's why Picard chose him. That's kind of more career-based than, you know, personal. But then the only other thing that comes to mind was the whole Beverly Crusher and losing Jack, you know, and her kind of hinting at a past relationship with Picard, but they didn't really delve into it until later.
Much, much later. Season 7 rolls around, and they finally resolve that relationship.
We do find out that Picard doesn't like kids.
Yes, that is true. We do find out that Picard doesn't like kids. Mm-hmm. I think maybe the reason why they hit Tasha Yar's backstory as hard as they did was because, like, Gene Roddenberry had this idea of the Utopian Federation, and so I think he really felt that this colony that Tasha Yar was from was supposed to be this big, like, aberration on this gleaming record of mankind. And so he hit that backstory a lot, because I think I've always imagined that he wanted to go there a lot more and have, like, that be a big part of the story. That was always my theory on it.
Well, that's interesting. I don't know what he intended, but often in when people thematize utopia, they do it by contrasting it to dystopia, right? So mm-hmm. How do you know what a good society would look like as you portray a really bad one? And I remember a line where Wesley can't understand why there's so much drug use on Tasha's home planet, and she says, first you take the drugs to feel good, and then you take them to keep from feeling bad. Mm-hmm. So it let them create a set of contrasts that would have been more abstract if they didn't have another society to point to where they could say, see, this is the bad version, and what we want is the good version.
What is the deal with her colony, anyway? Like, how... But is it actually part of the Federation, or is it, like, she's, you know, basically coming in from another country to, like, to find great freedom? And
I don't think I don't think the authors knew when they were making that.
It's just that I don't think that Roddenberry would allow a thing like that to be in the Federation, considering how much he'd even want, you know, people to mourn or feel sad. It's like, clearly, this had to be intentional.
I think the implication was that it was a Federation colony that, for some reason, that they never quite explained, the government fell apart and everything, like, descended into... It basically became an anarchy zone, and there was no way for the Federation to... there was no way for the Federation to really get involved. It was just, like...
That doesn't sound like the Federation to me. That doesn't sound legit. I mean, I feel like I don't remember people on the ship really reflecting back to Tasha Yar being like, oh God, this is a horrible thing, and can't, like, it didn't seem to be like an active thing that anyone was working on, obviously, but that doesn't seem like a Federation stance, you know?
But plus, it was hard to get into the Federation, you know, and a lot of planets that seemed qualified got not admitted because right. They had some fatal flaw. So I would think if that planet weren't in the Federation, they couldn't get in. And if they had been in the Federation, then the Federation would have had to take a more active role in trying to right the wrongs, because that government degenerated for a reason.
Right. Well, the reason why it was so goofy, or not goofy, but difficult to figure out, is that they've always sort of implied in other episodes that if you are a colony from a if you are a colony from the Federation, you are automatically part of the Federation. It's not like... whereas Tasha's colony seemed to imply that you could go off, found a colony, and be considered independent from the Federation, which is why the Federation wouldn't go in if your government collapsed. which is confusing because that seems to that doesn't jive with what we learned about the Maquis later, because all those colonies were considered Federation colonies. And so it, maybe there's a process. Maybe you go and found a colony, and then once you become cool enough, you're like, hey, Federation, we want to be official members. Yeah. That sounds really dangerous in a galaxy full of Romulans and Klingons and Borg. Just go off and found your own colony with nothing to defend you and just hope you last long enough to be admitted into the Federation.
But the really upsetting thing, thinking that it's part of the Federation, is, like, that's how they handle their internal politics. It's like, oh, this got too screwed up, we're not going back there.
Yep.
Like, you know, if one of those poor children managed to get to school, we'll let them come in, I guess, to Starfleet, but it's not really our place.
Sorry, go ahead, David.
I can't remember the specific line of dialogue, and I think it was in Encounter at Farpoint where Q was trying to put humanity on trial, and, you know, she has her impassioned outburst. And, you know, Picard is like, no, don't talk. But she's like, no, I must. And I got the impression that she was saying, like, you can't, you know, blame these Federation or the humans for being bad because they saved me. Like I said, I can't remember the exact dialogue, but it seemed like the impression is, you know, she was standing up for the Federation saying, these people do good. They saved me from, you know, my troubled past or my, you know, bad situation. I'd want to go back and watch it to see what she actually says. I mean, was it specifically about Picard and the Enterprise, or was it about the Federation saving her from that type of environment?
Yeah, I remember that speech too, but I can't tell you which of those it was. But I also think that sometimes what Star Trek does, it's very hard to reconstruct a clear policy to explain all these things, because what they do is they need a foil in a story.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, presto change-o, here's your foil. And they don't really worry too much about the, you know, how did X get to be Y. But to me, what the story allows us to think, whether they intended it or not, is that here's a planet that is described as pretty chaotic, and as basically governed to the extent it's governed at all by some fairly ruthless and immoral, or at least amoral, gangs. Mm-hmm. They're called gangs, right? But then we see other planets that are governed, or at least that host groups that aren't really gangs. They're more like rebel factions. And then we see still other planets where rebel factions actually become or are attempting to become new governments. And I think that's really intriguing because it blurs lines that often a less kind of creative view would keep clear. Like, that's a gang, that's a rebel faction, that's a government. And I think those three things are often pretty similar.
Yeah.
And that it's interesting to see a narrative that lets you think about the connections.
Yeah, and I mean, there definitely was a lot of interesting stuff to be had once we went to that colony. It was just kind of confusing as to what it said about the Star Trek universe as a whole and how the Federation itself functions.
Yeah, admittedly, we have kind of a similar problem with the Maquis, and not just in the obvious sense, but, like, we see over and over when we go to, like, colonies or other planets that still resources is a big deal. The fact that the Federation doesn't have to deal with that, it doesn't have the same issues,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, hypothetically Earth, there's food for everybody, there's healthcare for everybody. And it's kind of a weird concept that, you know, a weird concept for Star Trek to have that set up, because it's a bit more like Firefly, where it's like, if you're far enough out, we're not really going to support you as much as we could, but we have our utopia here.
It would take a long time to get there. It would take a while for us to, like, you know, FedEx some food to you on Starship. We don't have a whole lot of starships. They're busy.
But, you know, replicators, like, assumably replicators are made out of matter, which means replicators could hypothetically replicate themselves, and we have seen precedent for that, so
yeah.
Why is there still resource problems on the anywhere, but, you know, especially in any colony that's part of the Federation?
That's a really good question.
Well, we even see that it might have been just for fun, but we even see that Captain Kirk himself started, you know, using contraband, and he's like, "Oh, well, we're so far away from the Federation, no one's going to enforce it or don't worry about it." Well, when he were drinking Romulan ale at the state dinner with the Klingons, and they're like, "I thought Romulan ale is illegal," and it's like, "Oh, that's the advantage of being so far away from."
Romulan Ale is like the Cuban of Star Trek, as I understand it. It's one of those things where if you're important enough to be able to get some, no one's going to, you know, no one's going to enforce those laws on you. So that's an interesting conversation. But I have another thing that I want to get to before we get into our main topic for today, which is, first of all, Star Trek Renegades met their funding goal, which I'm very excited about. I think they ended up exceeding it by about $20,000, which is cool. I'm excited to see what they come up with. So if anyone who wants to check, doesn't already know what that is, should check out StarTrekRenegades.com. Take a look. It's a new web series that Tim Russ and Walter Koenig and a number of other people are working on. And this is the same group of people that put on Star Trek of Gods and Men, which Kathy and I just watched the other day. I rewatched it, and Kathy watched it for the first time. So what did you think about it, Kathy?
Well, it was such a pleasure to see Michelle Nichols and Walter Koenig in action. It was just fun to see them bringing their characters back. So that was my first thought, was I'm willing to put up with a lot of other less than perfect aspects of the story to see characters that I love coming back and doing interesting things and having to face dilemmas and overcome problems. And so that was very cool.
See, I had forgotten that at the end when they have this giant battle sequence, it's like, I feel like the special effects people were only kind of aware what was supposed to be going on in the story when they made those special effects. Because, like, they're on board the, I think it was the Conqueror is the ship they spend the most of their time on in that movie. Then the Conqueror is over the planet with the Guardian of Forever, and the Rebel fleet shows up. And the Rebel fleet is huge. Like, they show us this panning shot of what's got to be at least 50 ships. And they're all, like, you know, Enterprise, Constitution class, and, like, D7 battleships and Romulan, those, you know, the TOS Birds of Prey. They're big ships. And I'm like, wow, the Rebellion's a lot more powerful than they led me to believe. And then, like, they show them attacking the Conquest, or the Conqueror, whatever it was called, the, you know, Harriman's ship. They show them attacking it, and for the next several minutes of animation, all they show are these little shuttlecraft attacking. And I'm like, wait, what happened to that giant fleet of huge ships that we saw a second ago? And then the other giant fleet of huge ships, which I think is supposed to belong to Gary Mitchell, who is the king of the universe in the alternate timeline, shows up and is also a giant fleet of big ships. And then they show us like these big ships shooting at each other, but it's unclear who is shooting at who. And there's this giant glowy ball that some of the Gary Mitchell ships are pulling, and they never tell us what it is or what it was for.
What is their lucky golden ball? Jeez, Orin. Sometimes you have a good luck charm and you want to bring it with you.
It's like Death Star sized, okay? They blow it up.
It's really lucky.
Anyone who has watched Gods of Men, please email us at allthingstrek@hotmail.com if you can tell me what that glowy ball is. Because I have no idea what it was or what it was for. They also were, like, there are some weird scenes in the movie where they, some scenes they throw on some really heavy exposition. Like, there are a number of sequences where Uhura is just, like, mis-exposition, and she has given us the exposition. And then there are some sequences where they just decided, nah, you don't really need any exposition. And the characters are talking about stuff that we don't know what they're talking about. Like, it's very unclear what Chekhov's mission on the Conqueror was originally. And it's like, what was, like, you know, why were they there? What were they there to do exactly? They talk about capturing it and bringing it to their base, but what would be the point of that? Like, why would they do that? And, like, were they there to prevent the destruction of Vulcan? Because they were a little slow on the uptake for that. I had forgotten that Vulcan got destroyed in that movie, and I can only imagine that J.J. Abrams was watching it and was like, oh, that's a good idea. I should put that in my movie.
I'm so sure.
But, yeah, I was not clear what was going on in that movie, but I did enjoy it. I think for the budget and time they had to put it on, it was a very good fan production. I'm excited to see what they do with Star Trek Renegades.
It was also fun to see them trying to play to some people's strengths. They didn't always succeed in correctly, like, casting, costuming, like, I felt that Jake made a really poor Vulcan, the guy who plays
Sarah Clofton?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't feel, I mean, at least he's supposed to be half Vulcan, but I didn't really feel that he could pull it off, because it's part of the thing, he just has such an emotional face. Like, I don't feel that he doesn't radiate logicness, and yeah, I didn't really like that aspect. Also, he had facial hair, didn't he?
Yeah.
That was weird.
Vulcans have facial hair?
No, I'm not saying that Vulcans don't. I think he looks weird with facial hair. The thing I really liked was the guy who played Harry Kim.
Garrett Wong.
He is being Mr. Sexy and wearing one of Kirk's old, like, spangly outfits. Like, I think it might even be Kirk's, like, the alternate
universe. It was, like, his green vest that he wore for a couple episodes. And, like... he wore it over a shirt, but Garrett Wong doesn't need to do that.
No, I don't think so.
Well, there were some where he was shirtless.
Yeah.
No. Kirk wore it over a shirt, didn't he?
I don't remember. The Yangs and the Coms. Wasn't Kirk shirtless? I'm sure Kirk was shirtless many times.
Like, I don't remember him ever wearing it over a shirt, because then, you know, he would have looked more, what is that, like, Renaissance-y, almost?
Okay, well, hold on. Pause the conversation, because Gingy in the chat room just pointed out that glowy ball was basically the same ship from the episode The Corbinite Maneuver. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't even realized that. I wonder if that was intentional. Yeah. That would be really goofy if they just dropped that in there for no reason.
I liked it.
But yeah, you're right, Gingy. It does look a lot like that. So anyway.
Very interesting. Well, you know, maybe if the people who are writing it, I have no idea if they are, but I can imagine trying to lace fan-produced stories with lots of triggers that people like us who watch these things over and over and are really into it will recognize, or even not recognize and want to know about.
Touchstoning, I think that's called.
Is that what that is? Right. And that if they explained it all, it'd be less interesting to the people who recognize them, who want to, it's like a series of puzzles or just little conundrums, little invitations to remember an episode.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely really enjoyed the performances. Like, I think that the actors did a great job.
I thought that it was very flat, and I think that might be either the directors or probably how much they were being paid.
Yeah.
Like, I think that the writing wasn't nearly as bad as they were, you know, saying lines. Like, we know all of them can act better than that, but I feel it was read really flatly, and it almost sounded like a script reading to me.
Yeah, there are definitely some scenes where I've had that, where I felt that was a problem, was that it felt like they were reading their lines for the first time, like they didn't know exactly what inflections to put on them.
And I mean, like, if they were only paid, you know, a fraction of what they usually are, that it makes sense. It's like, okay, we'll have a rehearsal or no rehearsal. Like, I could see that being a thing. It's like, okay, this is a fan script, we're getting paid for it, but not enough to really, you know, prepare.
And one comment about the bridge cast was, I'm not sure you would really give somebody who's a slave a lot of responsibility on your ship.
Yeah.
Because, by definition, a slave is not there by choice, and even if she makes the best out of a bad situation by allying herself with powerful men, that doesn't mean she's going to be a loyal, reliable cast member.
Right,
I mean,
we're talking about the Chase Masterson's character, the Orion, who was manning the comm station, even though she was apparently Captain Harriman's slave. And we spent an awful lot of time with that character, even though we never really found out anything about her, and there was not really any reason for us to be interested in her.
I thought it was a mistake to put a slave at the comms just because... not very respectful for the comm, like, job.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that kind of implicates bad things.
Yeah, just a little bit. But, you know, I was confused why we were spending so much time with this Orion woman, who for most of the movie all she did was sit at her station.
Well, she sat at her station scantily clad. So.
Well, that is a thing she did.
She's quite a bit of eye candy. Yeah.
She also had a little bit of a goofiness thing where she got shot in the back, and then in the next scene she was clutching her stomach. She's like, oh, a stomach wound. Maybe it went all the way through. I don't know. But, okay, so done talking about Star Trek Online. No, we were talking about Star Trek of Gods and Men. I'm apparently really on top of it today. David, had you ever seen Star Trek of Gods and Men?
I've seen clips of it. I've seen, you know, a little bit of it, but I haven't had a chance to see the whole thing yet. But I have heard, you know, the story synopsis or a lot of anecdotes about it. But I do need to get into it and check it out from beginning to, you know, start to finish.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's worth seeing. I would recommend it. Okay, so today, after that, I think we will move into our main topic for today. And look, it only took us half an hour to get through all the pre-topic stuff. But we are going to be talking about the women of Star Trek, and we talked about this way back in episode 2. And I felt it was time we dust off the topic and give it another run, especially since Kathy is here, and that is one of her many areas of expertise. So, Kathy, where do you want to start?
Well, I don't know. There's so many things to say about them. I thought through several things that interested me as I look back, and one is the way in which women figure as political leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And I divided that in my mind between the women who were in some sense either a peace activist or a diplomat or in some way using words to create political bonds or solve political problems, and then the resistance leaders who were an armed insurgency.
Right.
And I just kept finding more examples, so just the quantity was quite fascinating and made me think about the significance of that in Star Trek as a theme. And so it's just a couple of examples of the famous ones would be the Edith Keeler character in the original series, City on the Edge of Forever.
Was that the one with the cloud miners?
No, that's the one that they go back to the 1930s.
Oh, right.
And she's a social worker.
Yeah.
And Kirk falls in love with her.
It was Joan Collins.
Joan Collins is the name of the actress?
Yeah, who played Edith Keeler.
I'd forgotten that. But as I looked at that episode again, I realized what a close parallel that was to Jane Addams.
Who's Jane Addams?
Jane Addams was an American political activist. She was an anti-war activist at the turn of the century, one of the outspoken opponents to World War I, and she was one of the founders of what we now call social work. And we think of it as, you know, a kind of, you know, people who work for the city or the state who help poor people on an individual level. But that's not how it started. Social work had a very radical beginning.
Right,
and it was not just soup kitchens, which Edith Keeler had, but it was also trying to change the society so there would be less poverty.
Right.
And also that connection of the trying to address domestic poverty through the profession of social work versus trying to address global violence through the job of through the role of a peace activist, that's historically right. Those two things did come up together. So that episode would be a great one to use in my Women War in the Military class.
Now, is this woman we're talking about the one in real life, was she the one who was elected to Congress before women were allowed to vote?
That's a woman...
Because I thought that one was very
fascinating. She's very, very interesting. I'll think of her name in a minute. She was the first woman elected to Congress, and she was the only person who voted against World War I. From Montana, I think. Jeanette Rankin.
All right.
But Jane Addams was never in Congress, but she did win a Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember in the alternate universe that Kirk had to let Edith Keeler be killed in the story because they had to prevent this other universe. And the story here got a little weak that Edith Keeler would have led the peace movement that kept the U.S. from entering World War II, therefore allowing Hitler to win.
Right.
Okay, so that was the counter history they told that made it necessary for Edith Keeler to die. And Spock even says at one point she had the right idea but at the wrong time, the assumption being that Hitler was such a uniquely terrible...
Such an unreasonable adversary that there was no way to deal with him except through violence
at that time.
Right.
And that, so, you know, that's all questionable as any counter history is, but I just thought somebody did their research on that episode, only they put it in... the lead up to World War II. Addams was the lead up to World War I.
Right.
And she did win a Peace Prize.
And I mean, the lead up to World War I would have been, like, they really would have had a much harder time justifying letting her die if it had been the lead up to World War I. Because obviously, I mean, a lot of, at least in the way we view it historically, World War II is seen as the just war.
Right, it's the necessary
like, you know,
war.
It's the war that we went to because the people we were fighting were evil and had to be stopped. And you could debate whether that's true or not. But World War I was very clearly a political conflict. There was no bad Germans versus good everybody else. The Germans were just like the British and the French and the Americans.
At least that's how we remember now. At the time, they told themselves stories.
Right.
You know, like
there's always propaganda.
War. Right.
But now looking back at it, we know that the Germans were not, you know, horrible monsters in World War I. So they would have, I think, looked really bad if they had told us that a peace activist trying to prevent World War I was the bad guy. I think that, or needed to be killed for history to move forward. I think that would have been a terrible story. But in that vein, do you think that because I know some people have a problem with that episode because they feel like the message of it is that peace was the wrong answer.
Well, that's one way you could interpret it, although they were trying to limit to it wouldn't work now as opposed to it would never work. So I felt like they, through Spock's speech, tried to address that.
Mm-hmm.
Still, as you say, they might not be right about that, but it's at least a more compelling argument than any of the other 20th century wars that they could have picked. So I'm willing to, I think that the episode is strong.
I have a question for you that's kind of like, it's more based on our world history. From my history classes, it seemed like a pattern that it was women that were always the strong activists that were doing who pushed social change. It felt like there were more women who popped up in my history books. And is that true? Is the like percentage of activists when it comes to social change, changing poverty, and like equality, is that usually women? Is it a high, like, or do they just pop up more because, you know, it's women popping up in history?
I think it is true what you said, at least in the part of the world I could speak for best, which would be the basically the mid-19th through the 20th centuries in the West. I'm not as knowledgeable about before the mid-19th century or the part of the world that's not, you know, the Western
Not Europe and America.
Yeah, or Canada. And,
mm-hmm.
Yes, I think with that qualification in general, especially in peace movements,
mm-hmm.
that it's typically women, and that one of the reasons that peace movements can be talked down about, can be, you know, insulted or made to seem a stupid idea, is because they're associated with women, and so mm-hmm. it's a wussy thing to do. You know, it's not tough.
Yeah.
But interestingly, beyond peace movements, civil rights movements, if you go back to the civil rights movement of the 60s and mm-hmm. 70s, of course, everybody's heard of Martin Luther King, but, and everybody's heard of Rosa Parks, but they think of her as a tired lady who sat down on the bus, as opposed to a very skilled activist who had a lot of training and knew exactly what she was doing.
Yeah, I mean, she had a career both before and after mm-hmm. that. That wasn't just an accident.
Yeah. And then there were tons of other women who are not as well known. And, of course, there were men, too, but we tend to individualize these things. We don't think of them as movements. And when you look at them as movements, you see how they were laced with women in leadership positions.
Like one of the and I actually don't remember the context of this. I'm just like these little cartoons like have remained in my mind for a long time where it was happening in France, and I want to say that it had to do like with the beginnings of a revolution or the pushing of like what the social change was next. There were these political cartoons where like it was men kowtowing to their wives and how pathetic they were, and it was trying to get them to stop the political movement that their wives were doing.
That's interesting. I wonder if that was a suffrage movement. Because a lot of women...
Sounds like something you'd get in an anti-suffrage ad.
A lot of women who became leaders in the suffrage movement, certainly in England and the U.S., were wives of middle-class men. And so on the one hand, part of their legitimacy came from that they weren't from the ranks of the poor.
Mm-hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
were educated, they were respectable, and so... votes for women of that class was a little easier for the elite to swallow than votes of, you know, the masses. But it also meant they went against their husbands a lot of the time. And so the husbands would be ridiculed for that. So that right. that does make a lot of sense.
No, I do apologize for trying to drag this back to Star Trek.
No. That's what I was going to say. The reason why I was asked that question is because it would make sense to me that we see a lot of women activists and like leaders in that sense in Star Trek. It would actually be weird to me if the majority is men over women in that sense, because it's not. It doesn't feel true in in history.
Yeah, no doubt. Kathy, so do you remember the episode with, maybe it was just called The Cloud Miners. I'm having a hard time remembering.
Yeah, it was The Cloud Miners.
Right, but that's the one with they have the big floating cities, and then you have basically the proletariat living down below.
Right.
I really liked that episode, even though at first I was a little bit weirded out, because you have like that lady who's the leader of the resistance movement, and she talked kind of funny and didn't really seem to know, like seemed kind of out of it. But they actually provided a pretty good explanation for that, which was that was part of the story, because she was living in caves full of this gas that makes you crazy.
Right. That's one of my two favorite resistance women who, rather than being peace leaders, are leaders of resistance movements, which might ultimately have peace as a goal, but in order to achieve it, they're fighting for their people.
Right.
And they're willing to use arms. And so they're insurgent. And her name was Vanna, as I recall, and she was the leader of the Troglite resistance. And I love that episode for many reasons. First, because as you say, the explanation of what was wrong with the situation that led to the Troglites being oppressed was, first of all, they did all the physical labor, right? They were the proletariat, and the people who lived in the clouds were the elite who got to have art and music and leisure and so forth and really unusual glittery clothes. But also, the poisonous gas that was released by the mining was both an interesting metaphor for the sort of the poisoning of a culture by it being overly confined to the worst aspects of human life, you know, the really hard work and the, you know, not enough of the things they needed, like food and clothing and education and so forth.
Right.
But also, in addition to being a metaphor, it was a very literal marker of what happens to people who do the least desirable jobs in our society, which is they're exposed to the greatest poison.
Right. And I thought it was actually a really good, just as a general symbol for the, because there's always the idea that, like, if the people who are successful are the people who have the ability to be successful. But I think the poison gas was a very good symbol for the, it's not really the people, it's the situation that they're in. It's the reason why these people, why those miners acted stupid wasn't because they were stupid, it was because they were in a situation that was making them act that way.
Absolutely. And then another thing that historically was really valuable, it made me really think somebody did their research, is that Vanna was able to rise to a position of leadership because she wasn't always confined to the mines.
Right.
She was one of that minority of the Troglites who were taken up to the clouds to serve as the servant class.
Right.
And so she got out of the mines. And just that in real life, it's often the case that the people who can emerge as leaders of an oppressed people are the ones who aren't stuck all the time in the circumstances that produce their oppression. They have some ability to get out, and that gives them more resources.
And this is reminding me of all the studies that have been talked about, how they, like, the original, like, Looney Tunes writers and animators had, like, all these various political views that they stuck into their, like, into their cartoons. Like, Daffy Duck is supposed to be a symbol of, like, of pure anarchism, and, like, Bugs Bunny is supposed to be a symbol of, but it's, I don't know, it's interesting if you look back and see all, because a lot of the writers of the 60s were influenced by the political change that was going on at the time. They didn't write in a vacuum.
Right.
So I think it's clear that there was a lot of research. Are there examples of that in more contemporary Star Trek?
More recent Star Trek. You mean the more recent of let's see. I actually think there's probably a lot of examples, but one comes to mind is still the Next Generation. I mean the original Trek, but I'm reading it from the present, which I think is perfectly legitimate.
Yeah,
I don't,
totally.
You know, I don't think these stories have to be kept in their context. It's
right,
what they
right.
do for us that we can find interesting. And I was going back to Patterns of Force, which is the...
You have to remind me what happened in that episode.
This is the original series where I think her name was Doris, appeared to be a Nazi leader, but she was actually a spy for the resistance, and the Nazi leadership was led by John Gill, the Starfleet guy who had gone there.
Right, yeah, Patterns of Force. They were talking about that in the chat room earlier.
Okay.
That's the episode where a historian goes to a planet and turns them all into Nazis.
Exactly.
Which, in hindsight, he probably should have known better.
yeah, not paying a lot of attention to history there. But he thought he was an exception. You know, he thought since he knew, he could avoid it and didn't realize the dynamic of power would work the same for him. But if you remember, the way that Kirk and Spock got in to see Gil was they posed as a Nazi film crew.
Mm-hmm.
And what that reminded me is the contemporary film Argo with Ben Affleck.
Oh, right, yeah.
Which is a real-life situation, right? They posed as a film crew in order to get the Americans out of Iran during the hostage crisis in 1979, I think.
Yeah. Well, and this was a smaller group of Americans that I think were hiding in the Canadian Prime Minister's house. It wasn't the main group that held hostage for more than a year.
Right,
side group.
Exactly. They got out at the very beginning.
Yeah. And that story tends to be overlooked when we talk about the Iran hostage crisis. Although, maybe Kirk and Spock would have had more success if they'd come in with clipboards and coveralls. But like, this equipment, nope, that's all going to have to go. And make marks on if you're making marks on your clipboard, people will basically let you into anywhere. But anyway, so that's another episode from TOS. I was just wondering if you think that style of writing Star Trek, of like researching, although did that episode of Star Trek predate their Iran hostage crisis? I think it did, right?
Because
that was the hostage crisis was 1979.
Exactly.
Oh, there's some foreshadowing.
So yeah, I'm reading back, you know, that what they couldn't have had it in mind, but it's an interesting pattern to watch it first be a Star Trek story, then be a real life strategy, and then be a Argo contemporary film about the situation. You know, that way of outwitting power, it's that recurring theme. I like that.
I'm trying to think of, like, because I know that the Klingons versus the Federation, that was representative of the Cold War.
Right.
And then, like, I remember hearing, like, maybe even you said it, like, that each of these wars represented, like, a counterpart in their real world.
Hmm.
And is that news to you?
That sounds like something I would have said. I mean, I've talked about how the Klingons were an allegory for the Soviet Union and the Romulans were an allegory for the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, then I feel like there was a allegory for Vietnam.
Yeah, well, there was a couple of those, actually, mainly in Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
There was the siege of AR-558. In fact, that was directed by a Vietnam War veteran who used his experience to help make the episode feel more real. Yeah, I forget the director's name. David, do you know who I'm talking about?
Not offhand. Maybe someone in the chat room can look it up for us.
If anyone in the chat room wants to remind me who that guy's name was, because he was a very good director. And then, of course, there was the episode, and I'm forgetting the name of it, but the one where Jake and Bashir go to the planet where the Klingons and the Federation are skirmishing, and they have very direct Vietnam War parallels there, because they have the Federation troops riding around in these things they call hoppers, which are clearly parallels for the, you know, for the transport helicopters that they used a lot in Vietnam. And they have that whole method of warfare with the tunnels and everything.
So what does the war in DS9, the big one, what does that actually tie back to real world?
I mean, the closest parallel that the Dominion War follows would probably be World War II. It has a lot going on that isn't directly a World War II parallel, but there are a lot of parallels to be drawn there. You know, in both instances, you have a case of a xenophobic enemy, which, you know, would be the Dominion and even the Cardassians to a degree, versus a group of, you know, allied states, which would be the, you know, the Romulans, the Klingons, and the Federation. And you also have a case of, in this case, I actually think the Romulans would be a metaphor for the Soviet Union, because the Romulans are the ally that they're not sure they want. Like, they need them, but they don't trust them.
Yeah,
no one trusts the Romulans. And they're both, and like, in the episode, Inter Arma Silent Leges, they're already preparing for the next conflict with the Romulans, which is basically what we were doing towards the end of World War II. We already knew that the Soviets were going to be our next big opponent, and we were preparing for conflict with them. So there's definitely a little bit of a parallel there.
I also think that in more recent Star Trek series, that the war stories got more complex in the sense that earlier, especially in original Star Trek, was the 60s. It wasn't that far after World War II. And so the invoking the Nazis hadn't mm-hmm. yet become as jaded a metaphor as it is now.
Right.
Now it's been so overdone, and it's used all the time to say that these people are so bad, they couldn't possibly have a point of view that we would want to take into account. They're simply bad. Right.
I mean, have you heard Godwin's Law?
No.
Godwin's Law is an internet rule that once someone in an internet argument compares their opponent or someone in their argument to the Nazis, the argument is over. There is no longer anything that can be gained because you're just throwing out platitudes.
Well, so where I'm thinking about this is with DS9, the relation of the McKee to the Cardassians.
Mm-hmm.
That on one level, that could be seen as an allegory for the Nazis and the Jewish resistance.
Yes.
You know, 'cause there was a Jewish resistance. And so the Cardassians, you know, are just the bad guys there, and the Maquis are the ones you root for.
Mm-hmm.
And that's often the case. The Maquis are often pretty sympathetic, although not always. But then that whole war becomes what in political theory jargon we call a floating signifier. And a floating...
I don't know what that means.
Well, I'm going to tell you what that means. That's my job. A signifier just means something that stands for something else. And so a floating signifier is one that isn't firmly anchored in one example.
Right.
That it can float around, and sometimes it seems to evoke this example, and sometimes it seems to evoke that example, and it's hard to pin down. Its power is that it has motion in it as a symbol. Right. So I think the McKee in that sense can be a floating signifier in the sense that they could also be the Palestinians, and the Cardassians could be Israel.
Yeah.
And of course, that's not how many people would want to read it politically. But if you do read it that way, then a couple of things happen. One is that the Cardassians become a little bit more potentially, if not sympathetic, at least comprehensible.
Yeah.
They have a point of view. They're not just evil. And even if it's a point of view that is destructive and unpalatable, it's still it has a logic to it. It's not incomprehensible. And as soon as you render your opponent incomprehensible, then the story becomes uninteresting because there's nothing to explore.
Yeah.
Right. And they also, the Maquis are just very interesting because they grow out of the, we're defending ourselves against the mean Cardassians, right? They grow out of that and they become, under Eddington's leadership, we are getting rid of all the Cardassians. You know, we are everything. They in a way, they become everything they hated about the Cardassians. They are attacking, these Cardassian colonies full of Cardassians that have never done anything to them. And they're bombing them with bioweapons, basically. And Gingy in the chat room is right. They did very often leave the Cardassians without a whole lot of redeeming qualities. But I think they fixed that in later Deep Space Nine with characters like, or not even later, but like in duet with characters like Aemon Maritza. And then they gave us a little bit more to chew on with Gul Dukat and Damar.
Damar became interesting.
But I think we have strayed a little bit off topic here.
Okay.
As much as I love talking about Deep Space Nine. So, Kathy, we talked a lot about women in TOS who were basically guest stars. They were there for an episode, they did some cool stuff, and a lot of them were really great characters. But how do you feel about the characters who were actually part of the crew? And, like, who were there for, like, reoccurring episodes.
So the original series.
Yeah, the original series.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm going to echo what's been said a lot about Uhura, which is that she was really important, and that early assessments of Uhura that said, oh, it's not an interesting role because it's communications, and communications is stereotypically female, I think that's the wrong tack. I think mm-hmm. we need to reverse that and say communications is really important. And
yeah.
the fact that women typically do it makes women more important, right? It doesn't make communications less important.
Right.
It shows you the importance of that gender presence.
And it would have been nice if Kirk had demonstrated an understanding of that importance, because there are a number of episodes where Kirk just seems really baffled that Uhura can't just call the aliens back. It's like, it's a little more complicated than that, Captain. He's just like, Uhura, why aren't you just doing exactly what I need you to be doing right now? And there are a number of episodes where that happens, but anyway, continue.
So anyway, I love her character the most in the original series.
I think that just like the Martin Luther King asking her to continue in the role, like that in itself shows how much, how important it was mm-hmm. that she was there, and how important it was that, like, yeah, we didn't have the first officer, which would have been really, really cool, but just her being there made such a big difference.
Yeah. One of my colleagues at the University of Hawaii, at the time, some years ago, a woman named Teresa Greenfield, did some research on why minority kids go into science, and she found a number of African-American kids that she interviewed who said that they were inspired by Lieutenant Uhura. And these were kids who were watching reruns, you know. They weren't kids in the 60s, probably watching shows that their parents liked, but they found Uhura to be inspiring. And it literally led them to take science, which is what King said to Uhura,
yeah.
was that she will open up science for minority kids. And it turned out to be true.
Mm-hmm. And Gingy in the chat room, again, is pointing out that the trend of women as resistance and, you know, political changers continued into Deep Space Nine with characters like Natima Lang. Do you remember her? The Cardassian woman who was a teacher and her students were resistance leaders.
Yes, that's right.
And also with Quark's mother, Ishka.
Right.
So I just wanted to point that out because Gingy his wheels are spinning. He's thinking of stuff. So here's a thought for you just on a storytelling level. There's a lot of theories that Janice Rand was originally supposed to be a permanent love interest for Kirk. And because if you remember, Janice Rand leaves the series very early for whatever reason. There are a lot of stories about why exactly she left. But the actress left, and the character didn't show up again after, like, the 10th episode or so. So I've always wondered how the show would have been different if Kirk had been in a steady relationship with Janice Rand. Because there is kind of one of the big things people know about Star Trek when you bring it up is the idea that Kirk was always sleeping with alien women. So how do you think the show would have changed if they kept Rand as a permanent character?
I think it's, and I know this is that people can like bitch slap me for this. I mean, sorry, but I feel that if you put a main character in a long-term relationship, what's going to happen ultimately is that there's going to be conflict between them because you can't have a uncomplicated relationship
right.
in a show. It has to be there for something. So I think that it would have been a mistake. It wouldn't have, like, we probably would have been exposed to a bit more sexism because then we'd actually be seeing the long term, unless they were able to show, it would be more complicated, I guess I'm saying. And I also think that in the essence of making this about adventure, it kind of is important that Kirk is that archetype of a hero where he is not really connected to any one person or any one thing. Like, that's a hero archetype that we see over and over and over again in mythology. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And it allowed them to develop the notion that captains are married to their ships.
Yeah.
Right.
And the only one then who could reasonably be expected to get out of that was Sisko because he wasn't on a ship.
Mm-hmm.
Right. He was on a station. And so he could have a mate who wasn't under his command. Whereas none of the other captains had anybody around that wasn't under their command. And that really complicates the captain's life.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard enough to negotiate erotic relations within a hierarchy at lower and middle levels. It's really hard, as General Petraeus could point out, it's really hard to negotiate them at the higher levels where...
Oh, man, we're topical.
Yeah, where the relationships are both personal and command.
But mm-hmm. I think that, like, Sisko is a perfect example of where that can go wrong, because, like, we were talking the other day about how so many people hate Cassidy Yates, and our conclusion that we came to is because Cassidy Yates wasn't really given much of a personality.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it wasn't allowed to have a real emotional conflict, and he wasn't allowed to really be in love with her in the same way that he was in love with the woman Red.
Right, from, I don't remember Mind's Image, I think is the name of that episode, but yeah.
Yeah.
She definitely had more of a personality in one episode than Cassidy Yates would often get.
That's also just more of an explanation as to why this relationship exists, and I think that Cassidy Yates could have been a lot more interesting if they had, if they were okay with more conflict and more passion in it, Especially since, to me, I understand why Sisko would be into a freighter captain, but they never gave her the earthiness that a freighter captain who's working with, you know, subpar equipment would have.
Yeah, that she was awful clean and well-kept for a person who was dealing with a ship that, from the sounds of it, was kind of falling apart and using substandard equipment. Yeah, that's definitely true.
She would have been more interesting if she'd been developed more as a Vash kind of character from the Next Generation. Somebody who's more unconventional herself.
Yeah.
And who's full of, I mean, she ended up being full of surprises in the sense that she's a Maquis activist, but...
yeah, but they never came back to that.
Yeah, and they didn't develop that, and they didn't give her... She tended to be just kind of prickly as a character, rather than having some more great dynamism in her character. She just tended to, like, she took offense easily, and then Sisko had to make her feel better. And there was something kind of juvenile about her character.
Do you guys remember the episode, and I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but since we're talking about Cassidy Yates, do you remember the episode where they were receiving transmissions from this Federation captain who had crash-landed on a planet, and they were going to try to rescue her? And she had like a background in counseling, and she was basically counseling the crew as they were going to try to rescue her.
Right.
And at the end, it turns out she was already dead because of time distortion. It is real sad.
Yeah.
But I like that episode. It's a good episode. But the problem that Sisko was having with Cassidy, which is one of the only times that Sisko and Cassidy's relationship ever had a problem, was that he wasn't comfortable having her on the bridge. And I was like, really? That's the one you're going with? It's not she betrayed me and was helping the Maquis and I haven't quite forgiven her for it? Or from her perspective, she sent me to prison? It isn't either of those. It's because they are not... It's because I don't have a problem with her on the bridge, which is not a problem we'd ever had before and never again. So I don't... Seemed kind of goofy.
Was she ever angry at him for how he handled the confrontation with the Maquis?
No, I mean, she never mentions it. It never comes up after the episode where she gets sent to prison. She comes back six months later.
It could have been an opportunity for Sisko to loosen up a little bit with regard to the Maquis. You know, because with Eddington, he was so single-minded. And having somebody who he clearly loves see the justice of the Maquis cause could have been used to make his world a little more complex.
Which is a little bit weird because there are other episodes, in pretty much every episode except for the uniform, which is the one where he and Eddington go head-to-head, Sisko actually expresses sympathy for the Maquis cause on a number of occasions. And so it's a little strange, and I guess the idea is that he feels so personally betrayed by Eddington that it overrides everything else. And of course, again, Gingy in the chat room putting out, he's batting 1,000, putting out that the difficulty with Cassidy Yates is that she was specifically designed to be a companion for Sisko, and she doesn't really have a character of her own.
That's a good point, yeah.
But
Can I say something about the episode you just mentioned where the woman, they tried to rescue the woman who turns out to have been long dead, but her communications in the sort of time-loopy thing that let them appear current, she basically counseled the crew.
Yes.
And I thought of that as, I have this sort of category in my mind of Star Trek's in which women do traditionally female occupations, as we talked about Uhura in communications. And there's one. Women are traditionally therapists. Another is...
although apparently that's more recent. That's a recent development, is the emergence of women as being prominent as therapists.
Okay, I don't know.
But you're right. I'm just pointing out that it's an interesting thing that we think of that as being a traditionally female occupation. Obviously, Counselor Troy comes to mind, but I just think that's interesting that's only a recent development. But continue.
Okay. Well, the other two I was thinking of is this is a original series where Roberta Lincoln on Assignment Earth was the secretary to Gary Seven, who was from the future. And,
oh, right. Doctor Who meets Star Trek.
Pretty much. And it's a comic episode. And it's intended to be a little bit slapsticky, and it is. But this is a woman in a secretarial role who shows how important what she was doing is. And another person I think of is, I know this is not your favorite person, but Keiko O'Brien. She was a really good teacher.
You're treading on thin ice now, Kathy. Now,
maybe she was not the best partner in the ice. World, but she was a good teacher. And she stood up to Vedic Wynn in the DS9 episode In the Hands of the Prophets, where she's teaching a scientific perspective on the wormhole, and the Vedic insists on a religious perspective, and it's certainly an allegory for creationism versus evolution. And Keiko was brave. And to me, when I think of therapists and teachers and counsel and secretaries, these are jobs in our world that are inherently very important, but they are typically undervalued because women do them. And they're not paid very much. And when men don't want to do them because they're not paid very much and they're not valued very much. And that I like it when Star Trek, in addition to taking women into conventionally male roles like of leadership and so forth, also shows that women doing things that are more conventionally associated with women made a hugely valuable contribution and should be valued more than they are.
And I totally understand that. But I will say the reason why I have a problem with Keiko as a teacher is that they have the episode where she's like founds the school basically. Her explanation is, well, I've never been a teacher or trained to be a teacher, but I've always wanted to be one. It's like teaching's not easy.
That episode, like, the reason why I never felt that it really showed how important teaching was that it kind of was like, well, there isn't a school on the station. And it's not like that's been no one's like, oh, this is a serious problem. It hasn't even been thought of before. It's just like, it's kind of like, wouldn't it be fun to have one on the station?
Well, I interpret it as an outcome of there being more kids, that the station had changed.
It's just that, like, I didn't really feel that there was the same urgency that I think that, you know, if you were in a community where there wasn't a school, like, there is an urgency to, like, have a school there. There's an importance. And I didn't feel that they really handled it in that way.
Although here's one possible explanation for why they hadn't thought of it. The station in the first episode was in orbit of Bajor, which theoretically puts it in transporter range of Bajor. So my assumption was that the idea was originally that the kids would just beam down to Bajor for class, but then they moved it to the mouth of the wormhole using a magic reduce the mass field, which they should be using all the time, but never mind. That's beside the point. They moved it, and then it was no longer within easy transit range of Bajor. It suddenly would take, like they mentioned, it takes a couple of hours to get there via shuttle, which makes me wonder if they understand how fast a shuttle moves. But, you know, that aside, that's what I suspect. I think what happened was they had this plan, they moved the station, and no one had stopped to think, wait a minute, how does that affect our schooling plans? That's my explanation. Well, sorry, go ahead.
One way that I also took it was that, you know, obviously it used to be a Cardassian, ore refinery, whatever. The Bajorans take it over, and now it's their, you know, one of their outposts. But in relation to the school, I kind of looked at it as, even though the Bajorans have taken it over and now it's a Bajoran station, and then here comes the Federation or Starfleet and they're doing it, I kind of took it as, even at that point, it was still kind of like a stopping point where people would be more transitory, and the longer the Federation was staying there and building it up, that it would become more of a permanent presence, a permanent, you know, living space for more and more people, and that's why you would want more facilities where it's not just like a truck stop, you know, in space type of thing, but now people are going to make their home there, and that's where Quark stayed, and other people are, you know, having permanent residences there instead of just like, I need like a hotel, or I'm stopping by, I need a hotel room for the night, and now I'm going to be on my way in the morning, like so many of the freighter captains would still do. But at the same time, there's more and more people living there now permanently, and that's why I took it. The other thing why I didn't think anything bad about Keiko being a teacher, and we've talked in previous episodes about we didn't get to see her do much about it, like it wasn't represented or shown, but it was established that she was a botanist, she was a scientist, and so at very least she would have been through schooling, so it's not like someone just randomly going like, I'm just going to be a teacher all of a sudden. Like, she would have been through years of schooling and, you know, been in classroom situations, so now it's like the flip side, where now she's going to be the teacher.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kathy, you were saying something?
I was thinking that one way that with a very small change in the story, they could have addressed Lillian's point was, in, remember early on when Sisko calls Quark in and says, mm-hmm. you're staying because we need the stable presence of these enterprises on, mm-hmm. Right. on the promenade. And so you're not leaving, and he pretty much coerces them into staying. And so, you know, they needed a bar, and mm-hmm. they needed businesses, and they evidently needed a tailor because they've got, a really good Cardassian tailor. So in that same moment early on, he could have said, and we need a school. Mm-hmm. And that would have given an opportunity to develop the school more as a site, and you could have actually had the children have interesting adventures and stories related to the school. Mm-hmm. And I also, in terms of Keiko becoming a teacher, I actually liked that as was just pointed out, her qualification wasn't she'd been trained as a teacher, but that she had been trained as a scientist. Mm-hmm. Because back before teaching was professionalized the way it is now, like my grandfather was a teacher, and he took his teaching exam in 1903 when he graduated from high school. And you had to have a high school degree, and then you had to pass a test. And it was a hard test. I've seen the test. It was very hard test. But you didn't study teaching. You studied the subject matter. And while Oren is right that teaching isn't easy, it's not clear to me that going to school and studying teaching is the best way to learn how.
That's a fair point.
I think that given the general mediocrity of schools of education, that often we'd be better off if we focus more on the subject matter and also paid teachers better so mm-hmm. they were more highly motivated, I think we'd get better teachers.
Yeah, and I do kind of wish that along the vein of, like, you know, like how our school system is not doing well, it would have been nice to see more experimentation of different, like, showing different ideas of ways of teaching.
Yeah, the possibility of field trips. Yeah. Would have been great.
Well, then we could have had an episode where the Keiko took her class on the holodeck, then the holodeck malfunctioned, and then they were all stuck on the holodeck, and there was probably some kind of giant, like, goldfish that was going to eat all of them.
Man, if I were a teacher on DS9, I would totally do my classes in the holodeck.
Yeah, so would I. I mean, especially because the holodecks in Deep Space Nine don't ever break down, except mm-hmm. when the entire station breaks down.
Yeah.
Which is, like, sorry, go ahead, David.
And that would have been a funny scene where, you know, Quark wants to sell his holosuite time to, you know, some alien wants to do Vulcan love slave or something like that. And now he's saying, no, you got to use it for the school. And Quark is like saying, but I'm not going to make profit. And, you know, that whole coercion where Sisko would make Quark, you know, behave or do things on the up and up.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I agree. That would have been pretty cool. So we talked a lot about women from TOS. So how about we move on to women from the Next Generation and more recent Star Trek shows? And obviously in the Next Generation we got Beverly Crusher as the Doctor, which I think was at the time, Kathy, because obviously I was only just born at the time. How accepted was the idea of women as doctors?
Let's see, what are the years?
This is like 70s? This was like. 1987 is when TNG was launched.
Well, the medical profession, I don't have the statistics in front of me, but my general sense is that it was changing, that the profession of doctoring was changing much faster than the profession of nursing.
Mm-hmm.
And so most doctors were still men, but the percentage of women in medical school was growing. Mm-hmm. And whereas hardly any men were nurses. That's more recent.
Right.
But I still think it was, while it wasn't really radical to have a woman doctor, it was fairly forward thinking of them to have a woman doctor, especially to be the doctor in charge, because she wasn't just a doctor on the ship. She was in charge
right.
of the entire medical establishment on the ship.
So, and then, of course, we have the much maligned character of Counselor Troi, which I actually think is a interesting example, because we were talking earlier about the women doing jobs that are traditionally seen as female jobs and showing how important those jobs are. And TNG did kind of do that in a really roundabout way with Guinan.
Yeah.
It's just weird that Troi is never allowed to do that. It's always Guinan who comes in and is like and gives and actually counsels them and helps the characters reach, you know, an insight into themselves.
See, the weird thing to me is that I don't understand why Troi is specifically a counselor. I would think that it'd be better to make her professional ambassador,
mm-hmm.
because that would make sense as to why she's on the bridge and, like, you know, sitting next to the captain and giving him advice on things. It's also that in this hypothetical future where we aren't even supposed to mourn,
mm-hmm.
why do we need a emotional counselor? Like,
right.
it doesn't seem to fit in with the vision of everyone being perfectly all right and fine.
Right. And I know there are a number of authors who have made, who have said that mm-hmm. Troy's role aboard the ship was partially that of an ambassador, even though they never showed it. But
no, like, we see her acting as an ambassador, and I don't understand why they wouldn't call her an ambassador, because yeah. clearly she's acting as one.
She could have been the State Department rep instead of, mm-hmm. You know, the...
And, like, they would have had to take a bit away from Picard. Like, he is, you know, amazing ambassador. He is the best at diplomacy. And they probably should have taken a bit of that and given it to her.
Just a little bit.
Because otherwise there's no point of her being on the bridge at all. And, like, I just wish I understood what their idea was when they made this character. Because clearly they didn't want her to do any of the things that, like, she was supposed to be there for. And they never allowed her to really be, like, useful in any way.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if maybe her role in Gene Roddenberry's mind, because she was an empath, was her role was to experience all the emotions that he didn't want the rest of the crew to experience. I mean, trying to pick apart what exactly Gene Roddenberry thought was going on in TNG is kind of difficult,
yeah.
Because his view, his idea for this new show was kind of strange. But that's the nearest thing I can tell, is that he wanted her to be, like, you know, he wanted her to be able to experience all these alien emotions that they were going to meet. Because, like, that's, like, the first thing she does, right, is pain, such pain. Mm-hmm. Everyone remembers that line from Encounter at Farpoint.
But,
so I wonder if that's our category. Go ahead.
No, I think, well, everything you've said about Troy, it makes sense to me. That what I'd add is that, as with other aspects of Star Trek, we're not really stuck with what the creators intended.
Right.
We can do more with it to, you know, in light of what we bring to it. And one thing I like about Troy, which I also like about many other characters, including Worf and Spock and B'Elanna Torres and best of all Dax, is that she's a mixture.
Right, right.
She's not one thing. You know, she's half Bajoran, half human. And so the sort of background story about Earth having cleaned up its act and solved all of its problems doesn't necessarily hold anymore, because these people aren't just, they first of all, they aren't on Earth, and secondly, they aren't all of Earth. You know, some of them are just aliens, but the most interesting ones are some kind of interesting mixture of clashing cultural norms and biologies, and that, so they have to find their way mm-hmm. in a universe that's where people aren't pure. You know, where there's boundaries are porous.
Right. The machine who wants to be human, you know.
Oh, exactly.
No one knows what character I'm talking about.
I definitely feel that they broke away from it, but, like, I still feel like there's a question mark of how Troy snuck in. Because, it really feels as if she wasn't supposed to be there.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe... It's confusing. I don't know where Roddenberry got the idea that people don't grieve, but they need a therapist.
I know that the therapist being bad at their job, that's not because she's a woman. That's because we don't like the idea of being manipulated by therapists in media. Like, and we also can't resolve stories just by someone, like, talking to us. There has to be more action, and there has to be, like, individual action. So having a good therapist in a show is really difficult.
Yeah, I mean, that's not just a Star Trek thing, like you pointed out. That's just an American television thing.
Yeah.
And if I had a nickel for every time American television or movies or American media portrayed, you know, therapists and psychologists being bad at their job, I wouldn't have to be doing this podcast, let me tell you.
And Star Trek didn't, like, they didn't have the brilliant idea that Babylon 5 had with dealing with telepaths. Like, you know, mm-hmm. Babylon 5, they really, they had laws in place about telepaths. You couldn't just be telepathic at anybody. You couldn't, you know, there were rules in place which meant that the writers could allow the telepaths not to know certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that was missing with Troy, was, like, she had these powers that because it would be impractical for or an inconvenience for the writers, they weren't allowed to like let her use them.
Right. Although, honestly, I never actually thought that that would have been too much of a difficulty. Now, if she was a full telepath, that definitely would have been difficult, but I think the writers were just lazy with Troi. I mean, like, having Troi be able to read her opponent's emotional, you know, state or you know, their adversary's emotional state or what have you, that doesn't sound like a very problematic thing for the story. Not nearly as problematic as having a machine that can give you anything you want at the touch of a button. You know, that's a real storytelling problem because you have to you have a hard time justifying why they don't do that every time they're short on something.
Mm-hmm.
But that is an interesting point about Star Trek. It always weirded me out that they're so cavalier about mind reading in Star Trek. They don't, mm-hmm. no one seems to think that it's wrong to just reach into someone's head and listen to what they're saying, like with the character of Lexana Troi, which is a nice segue because I wanted to get to her eventually. Kathy, how do you feel about the character of Lexana Troi?
I find her really annoying. I understand she needs to be annoying, and that's part of the reason she can be, provide comic relief and, you know, make Picard feel foolish and make Riker feel foolish and make Odo feel foolish. You know, I mean, she's really good at that. And then occasionally her act drops, as with Odo when they're mm-hmm. stuck in the
turbolift.
The turbolift, and she is willing to be more vulnerable, right? But, you know, another pushy mom, is that really what we need in science fiction? Can't moms be a little more complex and interesting than just overbearing?
Look, I think Gene Roddenberry was trying to tell us that the overbearing mom is eternal. It will always live on. It's just kind of weird. Did we ever meet the moms of any of the other characters? I mean, we met Worf's foster mom,
right?
who I really liked. Yep. And you know, ironic in a reversal, his foster mom was the one who was being like, "No, Worf's foster dad, leave him alone. Don't be too pushy. You know, mm-hmm. we're just here to see our son."
And she also, that was Helena Roshenko. Mm-hmm. She also was the one who said to Worf, "You've got to take Alexander."
Yeah,
and so
take some responsibility.
Yeah, exactly. You know, man up here, be a dad. So yes, I liked her. I thought she was an effective vehicle for confronting both the father and Worf. Do you remember there was a Next Generation episode, Inheritance, where we actually meet Data's mother, and her name was Juliana Tainer.
Spoilers, she's a robot.
And spoilers, she's a robot who didn't know she was a robot.
Oh.
And who was the robotic reincarnation of the woman that Dr. Soong
mm-hmm.
had been with when he created Data. So it was, in a sense, Data's mother. There was also Mugi.
Well, everyone loves Ishka.
Yeah, Quark and Brahms'
right.
Mother.
Yeah, and I know we meet the mothers of a few characters in Deep Space Nine. I was specifically talking about Next Generation.
Well, in the Next Generation, we don't, and it might be a similar case with Data, where it's kind of his mom, kind of not, because there's something different, or you know, a twist to the story. But we got glimpses of a few characters' mothers. We get a glimpse of Geordi's mother when she goes missing, and
yes.
for the most part, we end up dealing with his father, which was Bryn Vereen. And then, you know, it was the mother, but then there was like an alien twist because it was an alien manipulating the image. We also get a glimpse of Picard's mother in one of the episodes. I think the title, If Wishes Were Horses, I don't know if that's the right episode, but it's the one where...
Deep Space Nine episode.
Where, like... Okay, well, it was the TNG episode where... I think it might have been when the Traveler took them too far out into space or something. It was like, there was the guy in the corridor with the fire, and he's like, just think the fire away, and, you know, you control what you're thinking. And then we see Picard meeting his mother, his, you know, then past mother in the corridor.
Yes, I remember.
In that moment, it was like is that her ghost? Is it just a mental image? Because it seemed like she was present and, you know, sentient, talking with him at that point. Like, you know, it wasn't just a memory that he's remembering. It's like they were interacting in a... So there's a little bit of that. But yeah, I kind of wanted to see more of the parents.